It is Monday, September the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, is the UN Syria envoy too optimistic about chances of a ceasefire?
Extremely so, because he's not taking into consideration the incentives of the Russians and the Syrians and the lack of readiness of the Obama administration to intervene more forcefully.
Sudan's flight, the people in South Sudan, their plight, first U.S. presidential debate just hours away, plus the passing of two notable Americans, one from the world of sports, the other a famed musician. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The UN Security Council held urgent talks. It happened Sunday about the deadly surge of violence in the Syrian city of Aleppo as Syrian and Russian jet fighters bombarded the rebel-controlled eastern sector of the city. United States, France, and Britain called that emergency session to pressure Russia to control its ally Syria to end the attacks on the 275,000 people who were trapped inside of Aleppo. The assault, with missile strikes, barrel bombs, and artillery fire, has flattened buildings there, leaving streets filled with debris and chunks of concrete. The UN says 213 people have been killed in the offensive, and 1.75 million people in Aleppo are without water to drink. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Indiana University scholar Abdulkader Sino if the Syrian government thinks it can gain complete control of Aleppo.
Yes, of course. And in fact, they use those ceasefires to their advantage by trying to surprise the resistance forces, the opposition, and take advantage of a fatigued population. So the Secretary Kerry is really being taken advantage of in those negotiations.
Capturing the rebel half of the largest city in Syria, where more than 250,000 civilians are trapped, would that be a big victory for Assad's forces?
It would be a tremendous victory for him. He already controls most of Damascus, and Aleppo is actually the largest city in Syria. If he can control it, he can really claim legitimacy and victory on a large scale.
Well, the rhetoric at the UN got rather heated. Samantha Power, the U.S. UN ambassador, said what Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it's barbarism.
And she's absolutely correct. Now, also, however, one has to keep in context the fact that the Russians have their own grievances, and they're using Syria to really get even with the United States, and especially against sanctions that the United States has imposed on them in the past. So for them, it's an opportunity to get even and to have to show that they have a presence on the world scene and that they are forced to be considered seriously.
The Russian ambassador, Mr. Churkin, Vitaly Churkin, insisted that the U.S. is at fault because it's unable to separate al-Qaeda and Islamic State from other rebel groups. Is that a feasible argument?
No, because no one can do so. How can you separate those groups from others alongside which they fight? Listen, the resistance in Syria, opposition in Syria, has very limited options. And they're formed of different groups of people for reasons that have nothing to do with Russia or the United States. And it makes no sense to a more moderate opposition group to separate themselves from al-Qaeda or other organizations along which they fight. They are at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the regime. If they start fighting each other, they're going to lose immediately or very fast to the regime and Russia. It's unrealistic to ask them to start fighting each other just to satisfy the needs of foreign powers. And certainly not in the capacity of the United States to do so, because they can't possibly convince them to do so, because they're intertwined geographically and otherwise. In fact, they share the same front, and they cooperate really well, at least the previous al-Qaeda organization, Nusra Front, which changed its name right now, and other opposition groups. ISIS is more separate in most areas and can be isolated, and here the Russians have no argument.
The UN Syria mediator, Stefan de Mistura, appealed to the Security Council to come up with a way to enforce a ceasefire. He said he's still convinced we can turn the course of events. Is he overly optimistic?
Extremely so, because he's not taking into consideration the incentives of the Russians and the Syrians and the lack of readiness of the American administration, Obama administration, to actually to intervene more forcefully with the Russians and the Syrians.
We've tried two cessation hostilities, as they call them. Both have apparently failed. What's next?
More conflict. And the Russians and the Syrian regime are only going to stop if they win. And the resistance, the opposition is desperate, and they do their best, and they will find no reason whatsoever to sacrifice any of their comrades just to satisfy foreign powers who do little for them.
If Aleppo falls to the Russian and Syrian coalition, what happens next? Will the fighting start to ease back?
Well, it may actually start a domino effect in favor of the Syrian regime. And for the United States, it's a disaster because it will show that it was not able to manage the conflict in a way that's suitable to it and that it was outdone and outplayed by the Russians, which has repercussions all over the world.
And this would be a setback for the Obama administration foreign policy?
Absolutely.
Abdelkader Sino, he's a professor of political science and Middle East studies at Indiana University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among other stories we're following, videos released in the U.S. police shooting of an African-American man, plus an airstrike kills a senior Pakistan militant leader in Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of those stories a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. And just over a day from now, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will face each other in the first of three U.S. presidential debates leading to the November 8th election. Actually, it's probably less than a day. We're not certain what we may witness there, but Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins my colleague Jim Stevenson to share some observations.
Jim, they're expecting huge ratings for this. I mean, this could be the most watched event between now and, I don't know, the Super Bowl.
And I'm sure Trump will claim the ratings as another one of his shows.
You have two people who are no strangers to the debate stage. This is Hillary Clinton's second run for the presidency. And, of course, before that, she ran for the Senate and participated in debates. She performed quite well against Bernie Sanders, going back to primary season. And then you have Donald Trump, who was never accused of having a very strong command of the facts, but managed to barrel his way through just about every Republican primary debate earlier this year. And you have the two of them, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, going head to head. I don't know to what extent people will be watching this in order to inform their voting decision and to what extent they will be watching for the sheer spectacle of it all. But I suspect that a lot of people will tune in.
I've heard the pundits bantering around potential strategies for both candidates. The consensus seems to be that Trump needs to kind of keep himself reined in, if you will, for longer than 30 minutes, which may be difficult.
You know, if you talk to the Hillary Clinton people, they will tell you that they feel that, in essence, Trump has an advantage in that expectations for him are so low that if he shows up at Hofstra University in New York and simply sounds reasonably coherent, that he will win the debate just because people are expecting such outrageous things out of him. And if he looks with a sort of modicum of a presidential air and comes out with some things that people can relate to, that he will be sort of catapulted in people's estimation of him. Hillary Clinton is someone who, as far as I know, has been preparing for these debates for several weeks. And it's my understanding that she has these enormous notebooks full of facts and figures and things to sort of wow people with. I don't know that debates are really won on the strength of facts that one brings. There's a lot of style that is brought into this. And I suspect that if she goes into the debate a la Gore of 2000, who was someone who was very cerebral and brought a lot of facts and figures to the debate, but didn't fare all that well in the debate against George W. Bush, I suspect that that could be something of a tactical error on her part.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. By the way, VOA will have live coverage of the presidential debate beginning at 1 hour Universal Time Tuesday. Be sure to check out our website for all of that, voanews.com. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. In mid-December, the conflict in South Sudan will enter its fourth year, and official U.S. efforts, that is, to end the violence and bring stability to the world's youngest country will continue. To get an update on the current situation, VOA's Adam Phillips speaks with Ambassador Donald Booth, the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Booth was asked whether former South Sudanese first vice president Riek Machar remains relevant to the peace process after his flight from Juba in July to escape violence by his political opponents.
We're not taking a position on the leadership of the SPLM in opposition. That's a matter for the SPLM in opposition to decide. Riek Machar has left South Sudan, and he still obviously has many followers, including here in the diaspora in the United States. What we're trying to aim for is that it's not only one person that matters in trying to bring peace to South Sudan. It's bringing all those who are representing people who have been wronged, who have grievances, who want to have a role in trying to build a country that can live together in peace. And as I said in my testimony before the Congress, we don't believe it is wise for Riek Machar to return to Juba, just from a practical perspective of his safety and how that could be guaranteed. And if he were to go back again with the security forces that he went there with after the peace agreement, we've seen the result of that. And none of us want to see another battle in the streets of Juba. But we also don't think that that's an excuse for Salva Kiir to consolidate power.
You're talking about getting people around the table and all these different stakeholders. How do you do that? I mean, what is sort of the American strategy for how to bring peace and stability to the place, including this idea of sort of sitting around a table, drinking coffee, and working it out?
That's really for the South Sudanese to decide how they want to come together to figure this out. All what we're focused on right now is trying to get the Regional Protection Force, which was approved by the UN Security Council last month, to Juba so that there is a stability and a security so that they can begin to think through how they're going to do this.
What is the American interest in this? Why is it such a priority that there be peace there particularly? Why should we care?
Well, the United States was one of the major supporters of the right of South Sudanese to self-determination. We supported them in that effort. We were behind the Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005, which led to the referendum and their vote for independence. And as the world's youngest country, we felt that we should be supporting what we had helped to bring into being by supporting their struggle for self-determination. But more importantly, as I said, we are a friend of the people of South Sudan. And so we want to see an end to this conflict, to see an end to their suffering, and to see that they will have a better future.
In your opinion, how much support does the U.S. plan for an arms embargo actually have? And if it fails, what do you think the plan B might be?
Well, we've been clear that we have proposed an arms embargo in the Resolution 2304, that if the Regional Protection Force is not deployed, if there is obstruction of that, that we would press for the Security Council to consider an arms embargo and perhaps other measures to try to pressure the parties to accept the Regional Protection Force, which we see, again, is key to restoring peace and stability in Juba and opening space for South Sudanese to figure out their future in a peaceful path rather than a violent one.
But if the embargo does not obtain or you don't get that resolution, what then?
If we decide that the regional protection force is being blocked. We will work very hard to make sure that we have the outcomes in the Security Council that we're looking for.
You sound hopeful a little bit.
We're always optimistic.
That was Ambassador Donald Booth, the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Well, it turns out that researchers are getting a lot closer to having a vaccine against the Zika virus. VOA's Jessica Berman has the story.
The experimental DNA injection being worked on at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, or NIH, outside of Washington, is a newer generation of vaccine. A DNA vaccine works much differently than regular vaccines that use live, weakened, or dead virus to stimulate an immune response in the body. DNA vaccines are different in those that use copies of genetic material from a pathogen. This DNA is introduced into cells in the lab, which then replicate proteins from the virus but don't cause disease. When those cells are introduced into the body, Barney Graham, deputy director of the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH, says the synthetic DNA fragments mimic the disease-causing pathogen.
What we want is to present the outer surface of the virus to the immune system so that it can recognize that with antibodies and make more of those antibodies so that if you see the real virus, those antibodies can block it from infecting.
So far, no DNA vaccines are approved for human use in the United States, but researchers are trying. Early clinical trials of DNA vaccines are underway, but Graham's lab is trying to establish an effective dose for full protection. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And now it's time to find out what's trending online. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. The fatal police shooting in Charlotte, North Carolina was definitely trending on Sunday. The local police department released a video on Saturday following days of pressure from the public. The law enforcement also released photos of a gun they said belonged to Keith Lamont Scott.
I understand, G. You know, police brutality has been a big topic of discussion here in the United States in the past several months. What's the discussion like this time?
A lot of people online are under the impression that the police department highlighted the fact that Scott had a gun at the time of the incident. And many Facebook and Twitter users are asking why that's problematic since it's legal to have a gun in America. Others still argued it's not a good use of our time to discuss this particular incident so much when there have been shootings in both Baltimore and Chicago recently that left more people dead.
So not much different from the other police shootings we've been reporting in recent times. I also should add here that this may be one of the final police dash cam videos that will be released in North Carolina, right?
That's right. So a new law goes into effect on October 1st that will block the public from seeing these kinds of footages in North Carolina. Moving on to a more lighthearted topic, social media company Snapchat rebranded itself as Snap Inc. just in time for the release of their sunglasses that record video. They're called spectacles, and they come in three different colors and just one size.
How much does it cost?
So that's part of the debate, actually. It retails for roughly $130 per pair. And another debate is on whether they want to support the 26-year-old CEO, Evan Spiegel. Some say he's different from typical startup billionaires because he's not a Silicon Valley guy who is crazy about craft beer and being nerdy enough. Others say he's actually exactly that guy. Back to you, Steve.
You think it's all about craft beer? Well, it may be. It may be. Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA_IE. I should note that another high-trending story this hour just came out to the VOA newsroom. It seems that 87-year-old superstar golfer Arnold Palmer has died. He died while in a hospital in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from complications of a heart condition. There's a lot more on Arnie's death at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. The American Heart Association released a new study that uncovers yet another reason not to smoke. The study, published in the journal Circulation Cardiovascular Genetics, suggests that smoking can have a wide-ranging and long-term effect on our DNA. The research shows that smoking leaves a footprint on the human genome, a complete set of a person's genetic material, in a process called DNA methylation. A study author describes this as one of the mechanisms of the regulation of gene expression, which controls what genes are turned on. While the research shows the DNA footprint greatly diminishes 5 years after a smoker quits, it doesn't completely disappear from the genome even after 30 years of quitting. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for the latest from our music department.
You're looking mighty good to me. Everybody feeling okay? Everybody having a good time? You're in the right place, baby. Buck Rezani going out here to prying your business. But every once in a while, I'd like to know how you're doing out there. If you're feeling all right, you say, yeah!
That's musician Stanley Buckwheat Doral Jr., who rose from a cotton-picking family in the U.S. state of Louisiana to introduce his style of music to the world through his band Buckwheat Zydeco. Buckwheat died over the weekend at the age of 68.
No matter where you are, from, everybody gonna sing. Everybody gonna sing some here with Buckwheat Zydeco. Now those of you cannot sing, you know who you are.
Buckwheat Doral was a genius accordion player by all accounts and gained fame through his Zydeco music that he exported from Louisiana to the world.
Are you ready? Are you ready, people? Hey! Are you ready? Are you ready? Hey! Are you set?
Doral took Zydeco music mainstream, launching a major label album, the Grammy-nominated On a Night Like This with Island Records in 1987. He went on to jam with musical greats like Eric Clapton, play at former President Bill Clinton's inauguration, and perform at the 1996 Olympics closing ceremony in Atlanta. His nickname Buckwheat because he had braided hair when he was younger that resembled the character Buckwheat from the Little Rascals television show. And now, Buckwheat Doral and his band Buckwheat Zydeco with Tutti Frutti, written by Little Richard and Dorothy Labastri in 1955.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Lamb Bamboon, huh? Buckwheat Doral, unfortunately, has passed away. Spent a lot of time as a youth over New Orleans. Heard him play many, many times. He and Buckwheat Zydeco. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When a country is deemed to have stepped outside of international norms or standards, the community of nations may impose sanctions against the sitting government, non-state actors, or individuals deemed to be responsible for offending acts. The idea is to persuade the offending parties to change their policy by restricting trade, investment, or other commercial activity, and, in the case of individuals, travel to the United States. In the early years of this century, such was the case with Côte d'Ivoire. Seeking to facilitate peace negotiations to put an end to the country's bloody civil war, the United Nations imposed targeted sanctions on certain individuals who significantly contributed to the conflict. Many in the international community followed that lead, including the United States, which imposed sanctions on specific individuals beginning in 2006. Then, in 2010, Ivorians elected opposition leader Alassane Ouattara to the presidency. The president was recognized by the international community as the country's new leader. Nonetheless, the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, refused to give up the presidency, and the fighting, which had largely ceased in 2007, was renewed. More sanctions were imposed by the United Nations, as well as by individual countries, including the United States. On September 14th of this year, recognizing that the situation in Côte d'Ivoire has vastly improved, President Barack Obama lifted U.S. sanctions on the Ivory Coast. President Obama determined that Côte d'Ivoire's advances in restoring peace and democracy and developing its political, administrative, and economic institutions represent significant improvements since President Bush declared the national emergency in 2006, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner in a written statement. Côte d'Ivoire has taken important steps to strengthen its governing and economic institutions and reconcile the differences that led to war, said White House National Security Council spokesman Ned Price in a separate statement. Challenges remain as the country continues to tackle difficult land reform issues and works to ensure that the benefits of economic growth are felt throughout the Ivorian population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.